y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s-loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of suicide, self-harm, abuse, and graphic death. Listener discretion is advised.
In the late evening and early morning hours between July 12th and July 13th, 2015, 18-year-old Tiffany Valenti's body was discovered by police after it was struck by a train in Mays Landing, New Jersey. Her family was told that the promising young volleyball player had jumped out in front of the train, taking her own life. Tiffany was a typical teenager who struggled sometimes at home and argued with her parents, but had also been offered 5 scholarships to play college volleyball and couldn't wait to meet her college roommate. The New Jersey Transit Police quickly closed the case, ruling it a suicide. However, there were so many questions left unanswered. Tiffany's family is still left wondering what happened to her on those train tracks.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
Mm-mm. We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
All right, you guys. So you might actually be familiar with this case without even possibly realizing it. If you watched Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix, this case was on there. That episode was called Mile Marker
45.
Yes. So I remember watching that. I don't know. So, you know,
yeah,
just might be something you're already familiar with. But let's talk about no. What is wrong with me? I can never remember to say thank you to people. And I swear I'm a very polite person.
All right. Well, you stopped yourself and that's better.
That is better. Awareness. There we have it.
Yep.
Yeah. We want to give a hey girl thanks to Madison for writing this one up for us.
Thank you.
And the case was suggested by Chelsea Craner and Angela. And a special shout out and thank you to Danielle.
Okay.
All right. So let's get into it.
Tiffany Ida Mae Valente was born on March 3rd, 1997 in Mays Landing, New Jersey. Often referred to by her friends and loved ones as Tiff, she was a surprise baby to Stephen and Diane Valente. So Diane already had two daughters from a previous marriage, Jessica and Crystal, when she met Stephen in 1989, and they had not actually planned on having any children. But when Tiffany was born, her mother described it as heaven. Tiffany was a ball of sunshine. She was full of energy and excitement. She seemed to always have something funny to say. And Tiffany was a standout athlete at Oak Crest High School. She played a year of softball before she found her calling on the volleyball court. You guys, she was 6'3".
That is very, very tall supermodel status and apparently very amazing as far as volleyball goes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, can you imagine? That's a full foot, like, taller than me. Like, that's incredible.
It's
like,
over a full foot taller than both of us, yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, wow. And, like, how perfect for the sport that she played because she was a middle hitter. I was not familiar with this before. I mean, I've heard of volleyball, but...
Right.
She was a middle hitter, which was typically reserved for the tallest player. So her job was to be the first line of defense against the opposing team, and she was an absolute rock star in this position. She also played for the East Coast Crush Volleyball Club, a traveling team that would help prepare her for the possibility of playing college volleyball. Travel ball, man, that's a dedication right there.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't even imagine. Tiffany graduated from Oak Crest in 2015 with varsity letters and ranked as 8th in the state for the number of volleyball kills she had. She received a volleyball scholarship to play at Mercy College in Dobson, New York, and she was super excited to attend in the fall of 2015. In her recruiting profile for colleges, Tiffany wrote the following, quote, "I started playing volleyball my freshman year of high school. As soon as I touched a ball, I knew my life was about to change. Before then, I was dedicated to playing softball. In my sophomore year, I decided to pursue a dream to play volleyball in college. I cannot see myself not playing it." That's also like such preparation for the future. Like to say in high school, because who, like, I wasn't thinking like that in high school. I mean, I knew I wanted to make good grades and I wanted to get into college somewhere. Mm-hmm. Which didn't matter because I couldn't afford to go once I even got in, but neither here nor there. But like, she sat there and thought, I want to be able to play this in college. So I have to do the things that I need to do now to set myself up for that.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to play on this traveling team. That's a very intentional planning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of a teenager. I mean, it's really incredible. Tiffany's club volleyball coach, Allie Walker, said that he loved being her coach. That may be Allie. What do you
think?
Could
be Allie. Yeah.
Yeah. She, quote, "She was an excellent volleyball player, but an even better teammate. She worked so hard to get better, which became evident when she received her scholarship. Tiffany lit up the court with her smile and was always the first to encourage everyone on the floor." While Tiffany dreamed of representing the U.S. at the Olympics in women's volleyball, she also looked forward to earning a degree in criminal justice. She planned on following in her uncle's footsteps and going into law enforcement. She even told her family that she also thought about joining the United States Air Force one day. Tiffany was not the kind of girl who gave up easily. I mean,
clearly.
Right? Like, just the steps that she's taken to plan everything out and then actually work for those things as a teenager. I just cannot get over that. She was very passionate. She was smart. She had a special knack for caring for her niece and nephews. Her cousin Danielle recalled that the last time she saw Tiffany, it was the night before she died, and Tiffany had come into the restaurant that Danielle worked at to pick up her parents. She and Tiffany watched as their moms danced to the live music at the restaurant, just like laughing at them, everybody being silly. And she said that having Tiffany as her cousin was just like having a sister. One of the best things about Tiffany was that she lived in the moment. She tried not to worry about anything. She made the best of every situation and seemed to always have a smile on her face. Tiffany radiated love and happy thoughts and was so excited to move on to the next chapter of her life in college. And she'd already been chatting with current members of the college volleyball team, and she was set to move in on August 18th.
On Sunday, July 12th, 2015, Tiffany and her family were celebrating her cousin's graduation at a party across the street from their own home. The party had been going on for several hours as the crowd, they steamed clams, they played games, and Tiffany, of course, played volleyball with her friends. I've never even had a steamed clam. I'm going to be honest with you right now. I don't know what that tastes like.
I'm not an oyster person, so I don't know about the clams. Yeah. I don't do mussels.
I have had mussels before. They're not bad. I had to like brace myself. I don't know. It was like a mind over matter type of situation where I was like, I don't know if I can do this.
Yeah.
I tasted it and it was delicious, but I still had something weird going on in my brain about it. But anyway, it's just who I am as a person. 18-year-old Tiffany was telling neighbors and partygoers about how excited she was to leave for college in just over a month. And she couldn't wait to join the volleyball team and make some new friends while getting to do what she loved. She was even making plans with her sisters about going to secretly buy a kitten for Diane's birthday surprise the next week.
That's sweet.
It is really sweet. Around 9:15 p.m., Tiffany went back across the street to her house. And shortly after that, Tiffany's mom, Diane, got a call from one of Tiffany's friends, Jamie. Jamie said that she and her mother were pulling up to the Valente house and asked if she could come out to speak with them. In their driveway, Jamie confronted Tiffany in front of both of their mothers, and she accused her of using her debit card without her knowing. Diane later said that Jamie was upset. She was yelling at Tiffany about the debit card. Tiffany denied the accusation, but then after Jamie and her mother left, she did end up admitting to her mom that she had used Jamie's debit card. But she said, you know, myself and our friends, they do that when, like, it's done when necessary kind of thing.
I would love a little more information about that. Like,
I agree.
Like, I would think that if you guys use each other's debit cards when it's necessary, that would be with permission.
Right. And maybe there are some,
I don't know what that means.
Well, yeah. And like, maybe there are some understanding rules of like, well, don't go crazy and buy $200 worth of stuff, because when you're 18, gosh, $50 is a big
sometimes.
Yeah. I
mean, I can't even count how many times I was like, I'll have $2.40 in gas, please.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah. And I guess keep going, because I may have just answered my own question. Go ahead.
Right. And we just don't know what we don't know. But she explained that one night recently, she was hanging out with Jamie, who had been drinking, and Tiffany had used Jamie's card to buy Jamie meals and a few items. The total had come to about $86. Diane was upset that her daughter had gotten into the situation and told her that she'd have to tell her dad. Diane walked inside to get Steven and then walked back outside. And this is in less than a minute. And at that point, Tiffany is gone.
So I wonder, okay, I'm just trying to think, like, because we've all been in situations where, like, you've been with friends drinking or, you know, whatever. Like, I'm trying to think. So, like, say one of your friends is, like, passed out drunk. And you needed to get them, like, in this day and age of an Uber or something, maybe. But, like, I just don't know. How would you buy them? Maybe she tried to buy her food to sober her up, or...
I don't know what kind of items.
It just seems like, why would Jamie
need.
Be so mad about it if it's like, well, I was buying food for you? Like,
right. It's not like she went on a shopping spree. As far as I know of, she didn't go on a shopping spree and just bought herself a bunch of stuff and then was like, oh, well. From what I am getting from this, from what we know, is it didn't seem like Tiffany was taking advantage of Jamie being drunk by using her debit card for frivolous things that she just wanted to buy. But again, we only know what we know. So I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. We just don't, you know, I'm just trying to like think about like, okay, how would that.
Right. How would that play out? What would that
come
actually,
about? But if she was in fact buying stuff for Jamie, then you would think Jamie wouldn't be that upset. Possibly a misunderstanding. I don't know.
But also, I don't know. Maybe it's one of those things where, like, hindsight, right? I mean, like, oh, if Tiffany had just had a conversation with Jamie and was like, yeah, I mean, you know, we do this all the time. And you know, yeah, I did do it, but I didn't think it was that big of a deal. And maybe like, okay, I'll pay you back because it was more than whatever. I don't know this whole situation.
Right. Yeah. It
could have worked itself out. I don't know, you know, because Jamie seemed to be really, really upset about it and was screaming at Tiffany. Maybe Tiffany was like, oh God, you know, I mean, we all do things and make up stuff and deny when we actually, you know, like it happens. I don't know. I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just a, like, I don't know. I've just never been in a situation where like, but she said like, we all do it. So it's like, this is a thing that has happened. Like, why are you this upset about it?
Yeah.
Just interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. Diane and Stephen, along with Tiffany's dog, Tucker, walked down their driveway and out onto the street. And the party was still going on at the, you know, the party that they were at prior. That was still going on. So there were cars parked along the dead end road, but there was no sign of Tiffany. They asked everyone around if they'd seen her, but no one had. She hadn't returned to the party either. So Stephen and Diane, they walked down the street. They're looking between houses, through the trees. And they mentioned that Tiffany was very scared of the dark, so they could not imagine that she had gone too far on foot in the dark. Like, Tiffany's sister was texting everyone she could think of, all of Tiffany's friends, but nobody had seen or heard from her. Diane and Stephen continued to call Tiffany's cell phone and texting her, but she did not respond. Stephen remembered that he had a trail camera near the driveway, so they checked it, hoping to see where Tiffany went. At 9:28, a photo was captured of Tiffany walking down the driveway, and she was wearing her jean shorts, a t-shirt, a pair of canvas shoes, and a white headband. And she was walking straight, but her head was turned away from the camera like she was looking at something. And if you do watch the Unsolved Mysteries, you can see it almost looks like she's looking, if I'm remembering correctly, like she was looking behind her, like somebody has tried to get her attention or something.
Yes,
or,
like she heard something and was like, huh? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Her head is not just like slightly casually turned. It's completely turned. Yeah.
Yes. At 9:29, Diane, Stephen, and Tucker walked out into the driveway, and it seemed as though Tiffany had disappeared in less than a minute. Someone went to Tiffany's grandmother's house, and this is just a half mile away, but she wasn't there. No one had seen Tiffany walking away from the home or down any of the nearby streets. And remember, I mean, she's 6'3", so it's not really easy to miss her walking. I mean, I'm sure she gets a lot of attention from just her height alone. And
right.
I mean, just after 11 p.m., as everyone continued calling, texting, and searching for Tiffany, Stephen noticed something flat in the grass laying in front of their house. It was Tiffany's cell phone, and this is just about 5 to 8 feet from the road. This is when panic, like actual panic, had set in. Tiffany is 18 at the time. She never let her cell phone out of her sight, as many teenagers and young adults and even myself sometimes do.
Mm-hmm.
You always have it. I mean, Tiffany was so all about her cell phone that she even bought a waterproof case for it so she could use it in the shower. Like, she had that with her all of the time. She would not leave it behind. Something got to be wrong here, right? Tiffany's uncle, Michael Valente, he drove around the area looking down nearby roads, off into wooded areas. Around 12 a.m., he drove down Pomona Road, crossing over the railroad tracks. Michael looked down the transit access road that ran parallel to the tracks and saw several flashing blue and red lights, and he immediately had a bad feeling. So he drives down the access road. He gets out of his vehicle and he speaks to the Galloway Township police officers. One of the officers told him that someone had been hit by the train, possibly a female. The Galloway police said that they were just helping out and that the death was in the jurisdiction of the New Jersey Transit Police. Michael asked them if they'd seen Tiffany and described her for them, and one of the officers said they could not be positive, but they thought the person struck by the train was the girl that he was describing. They asked Michael if he could identify the body. Cannot even imagine. He walked on the tracks and he found a horrific, absolutely horrific scene. The person who'd been hit and killed by the train was his 18-year-old niece. Around 2:30 a.m., this is now Monday, July 13th, Diane and Stephen walked out of their house as a police cruiser pulled into their driveway. Michael got out of the vehicle along with the officer and told his brother and sister-in-law that their youngest child was dead after being struck by the train. Michael, who was on military leave from working at the New Jersey State Patrol, was extremely distraught and unable to elaborate. And it was reported that for the next several hours, Diane and Stephen believed that Tiffany had been in a vehicle that was struck by the train and killed. Several hours later, after seeing social media and the news alert, they found out that she'd been struck as a pedestrian.
Oh my gosh, I just can't. I also don't understand why the police would put it on a family member. Isn't that part of their job? Death notifications?
I would think so.
They're like, okay, you got this. What?
Like, we'll be there, but I mean, you're gonna take over here, right?
Yeah, you've got it. You probably can do better than we can. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Stephen later said that he lost a part of his life that day. Tiffany's family was shocked and absolutely devastated. And I mean, can you even imagine? You're like, went to a family party. Everything was fine. Okay, we had like a slight dust up after the party was over. Nothing we can't get through. It gives me chills. You just don't expect that, okay, she's walked off, we can't find her. And still the worst you're thinking in your mind is she's going somewhere to cool off, she's going to a friend's house, whatever. And then your brother-in-law pulls up in the driveway and says, no, she was killed by a train.
Right.
What? Like, oh my gosh. And before the family could even process that Tiffany was gone, the New Jersey Transit Police had ruled her death a suicide. An article published on July 13th. Oh my God. I went, what is his name? I love him so much on that chapter. Mike?
Oh, yeah.
The 13th. That's how he would say it, right? Because is he Irish?
The Irish do say that a lot. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know what happened there. On July 13th, by the Press of Atlantic City, said the following, quote, Tiffany Valente, 18, of Mays Landing, was standing on the tracks near Tilton Road in Galloway Township, but did not move when the train's engineer sounded the horn and applied emergency brakes, said New Jersey Transit spokeswoman Nancy Snyder. Diane said her daughter was not depressed. She was not suicidal. She was happy. She was making plans for the future, for college. She'd already made plans with her future roommate for the fall. And Tiffany had plans to play softball on Wednesday, and she was supposed to go to Six Flags the next day with her friends. And Diane insisted that there was absolutely no way that Tiffany would have killed herself. On July the 11th, the day before she died, Tiffany tweeted at 12:14 a.m., quote, dude, I probably should be, but I'm kind of content RN, which is right now. Did she mean to say I shouldn't be, but I'm kind of content right now?
I don't know.
I gotta think that's what it is. Or maybe, because it wouldn't make sense if she was like, I probably should be, but I'm not kind of content. You know, like, to do in the kind of content part doesn't really make sense. So, and this may just be a typo. I'm not totally sure. But that sounds like that she's kind of content right now. So I don't know what the I probably shouldn't be would be referring to. But, and while some people who die by suicide don't show signs of depression or sadness outwardly, it was incredibly difficult for those who knew Tiffany to, like, who knew her the best to comprehend that she'd been so unhappy that she would take her own life. The train that struck Tiffany was New Jersey Transit Train 4693. It had left Philadelphia at 9:50 p.m. that evening and was heading east to Atlantic City. There were about 60 passengers and crew on board when it struck Tiffany at 11:12 p.m., right by mile marker 45. The impact appeared to be on the lower left side of the train near the track. The location where Tiffany was found was about 3.5 miles from her home and well into the dark woods. There were two engineers on board that night, one senior engineer, Wayne Daniels, and an apprentice engineer, Marvin Olivares. I'm not totally sure how to say his name. In an initial statement obtained by the police at the scene, Daniels and Olivares, said that the approximate location of the train when trespasser was first observed, so I guess that is the name they give to anybody who crosses onto the tracks, I don't know, was essentially right on top of Tiffany. They signed a joint statement stating that the engineer, quote, blew the horn and rang the bell, as well as put train into emergency brake application. Their description of what Tiffany had done was that she had like dove in front of the train and that there were only two witnesses. The New Jersey medical examiner, Daksha Shaw, released the autopsy report for Tiffany, which explained the findings. The final pathological diagnosis included extensive crushing injuries covering entire body, multiple organs recovered from the scene and collected in separate bags. That's heartbreaking. Fracture of all extremities, amputation of all extremities. That is rough. Her cause of death was ruled as multiple traumatic injuries, and her manner of death was listed as suicide 5 days following her death. There were no drugs or alcohol in Tiffany's system. There were reportedly no attempts to collect DNA off of her remains, and there was no rape kit done. You could look at that as faulty investigation, like you didn't do it. It's also possible it could not be done. You know, there are sometimes that bodies are found, and just because of the elements and things like that, they're not able to recover stuff. I mean, fracture and amputation of all extremities. Organs were just found. Like, that's, oh my gosh, that's just so heartbreaking.
I do think, though, and maybe I should hold on to this for until closer to the end, but the fact that the New Jersey Transit Police were in charge of this, if you want to call it an investigation, whatever you want to describe it as, the fact that they were in charge of it and the township police, Galloway police, excuse me, they were just there to like assist. That doesn't, like,
moral support.
Yeah, that makes me wonder if they were just, because again, if you watch the Unsolved Mysteries, there's a lot of talk about the fact that the New Jersey Transit Police, they are not used to investigating homicides, even if you want to say it's a suicide or you want to say it's a homicide, they're not used to doing anything, a dead body. Mm-mm.
Exactly. Anything involving a dead body. We just had some friends recently get back from doing like this tour in Europe. And so they visited several different places. And one of the places that they visited was Belgium. And they were on a train going from one city to another and, you know, whatever, they were going to do some tours there or whatever. Well, while they're on the train stops abruptly. And, you know, they're like, we're looking around because we're not used to riding trains even. And nobody seems concerned. And so we're just like, maybe there's a mechanical error or something like that. Like, I don't know. So they're hanging out there for a while. And then somebody comes on and tells all of them to get up off the train. And they are now going to walk to the next train stop through the woods, whatever. Well, this had happened. They had struck somebody on the tracks. And so their tour guide told them that in Belgium, this is super common. Like, it happens all the time. This is according to the tour guide there. And because they both, our friends were like, nobody was upset. Like, we were like,
oh my gosh,
devastated. And like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we were on a train and it hit somebody and like all this stuff. And they were all just like, all right, to the next, you know, the next stop we go. Like, They said it was very common, but I say that just to say that, like you said, but this train authority, that was not a commonplace thing for them. This is not something that they'd seen over and over and over again, you know, just...
So they would even know, like, and again, I don't know, I'm using the information that I have that has been given to make these opinions or whatever. But I just wonder, like, do they even know proper protocol? Were they even, it seemed like they were just ill-equipped to handle anything like this. And whether or not if they even had investigated it, like, could they have investigated? I don't know.
Right. Because there are a lot of things that, like, you know, the family attests that they didn't even interview them until Diane was like, hello, when are you guys going to call us? Like, right. She shouldn't be the one to remind them to do that. Like, everything that we know about evidence collection and the things that you do in an investigation, and of course, we're not investigators. Like, I'm certainly not trying to say that, but we have looked into, what, probably 500 investigations now? I mean, we've seen a thing or two.
Like, well, and we've picked up stuff just from doing this where it's like, well, that doesn't sound right. Like, mm-hmm. You know.
And like, how many, and you'll hear interviews with investigators and things like that, and they'll say, you can't make a snap judgment like that. You can't just one day, right? You could end up being correct if you've got two options, homicide or suicide. One of them is going to be correct. You could flip a coin, right? But you don't say that on the front end and then try to get everything to fit that, right? You look into everything. You look into the history. You do your due diligence. You collect the items. You send what you can for testing. And I'm not saying they could send everything because I understand that her body was not in a position that would be ideal for that, or in a state that would be ideal for that. But you certainly do everything that you can. And it just seemed like in this instance, the family led the charge.
Mm-hmm. Well, even to the point, and again, we're probably stepping all over on the points that we're going to make later on, but Tiffany's uncle and cousin, they went out and kind of did their own, I don't want to say search, but they were looking in the area that this happened, right? Nobody like taped it off as a crime scene. It's been contaminated, obviously. So it's like, you know, people can come and go as they please. They didn't collect all of the things even. There were so many things left at this scene.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make any sense to me. And then let's just keep going. But like, it's just, right. I'm just saying, like, it's not fair, in my opinion, to even call it an investigation because not a whole lot of investigating was done here.
Exactly. On July 20th, Tiffany was laid to rest after a service at St. Vincent de Paul Church in Mays Landing. And a few days later, her remains were cremated. The Valente family was determined to prove that Tiffany had not died by suicide. So they wanted to find out what really happened and who was responsible for her death. They hired an attorney, Paul D'Amato, to help them investigate the strange inconsistencies in Tiffany's death. And when D'Amato first met the family, he recalled feeling sad after reviewing all of the records, that he'd be forced to tell the family that Tiffany had in fact died by suicide. But he ended up being shocked at what he found.
On July 18th, Senior Engineer Daniels was put under oath to make his sworn statement, which contradicted what he told investigators on the scene. He actually said that he did not see the person approaching the tracks that night because he was completely turned around and talking to the conductor. And he said that he'd heard the student engineer blow the horn and put the train's emergency brakes on, saying that a girl had jumped out in front of them. And Daniel said, quote, "So at the time of the impact, I didn't see anything because I was turning around to say something to Bill."
Okay, I have a question.
Sure.
I'm thinking of, okay. So there have been times where like a car wreck or something that happens, right? And so somebody says, like, you see something on the side of the road or whatever. I have a perfect example.
Okay.
A guy, I'm trying to think of like a particular instance because I just feel like this can happen. And I'm not saying he, just hang on. Okay. So
yeah, just say more words.
I was driving down the road and I saw a guy laying in the road. Well, he was mostly on the sidewalk. His legs were hanging off the sidewalk into the road.
I remember
and
this.
He's kind of rolling around, seeming uncomfortable. So I stopped my car here so that, because I was afraid somebody was going to not see him and they were going to run over his legs. There was an ambulance that had stopped and was like in the parking lot of where he was at. And the EMT was getting out and approaching him. And there was another guy in a truck stopped, like, I guess just further up from him. So I was kind of like the truck was here and I'm here. And then the guy's like right here. So we're kind of like making a barrier. Traffic's going to have to go around, whatever. And so I go to get out of my car and he looks at me and he says, he got hit by a car. This guy just got hit by a car. And I was like, oh my God. And he said he was stepping out into the street and a car hit him. And then they just pulled away. So then somebody else pulls up next to me and rolls their window down, says, "What happened?" And I said, "He got hit by a car. He was walking out and somebody hit him." I didn't see that happen. So I guess I'm just saying, like, that is an inconsistency. But I think sometimes when we receive the information that we take to be, you know, true, then we will, it's a telephone game. It will pass it along, you know, that kind of stuff. I just thought about that, like, that can sometimes happen. It's very important, though, to delineate that.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So, I mean, the difference in, with what you're talking about, which is, it's good to note, but the difference is the police weren't like, "What did you see?" And you said, "I saw him get hit by the car, and now he's right over there." That didn't happen.
Well, and I also wonder, is the transit authority setting up for inconsistencies because they're not asking the right questions too, you know? Like, yeah. I wonder if the, I don't know who is in the transit authority, Bob from transit authority is like, "Hey, y'all, what happened?" You know? And then they're just like, "Oh, yeah, man, she jumped out." Just,
yeah.
Like, and then later they sit him down and do a real interview and then ask like, "Well, more detailed questions."
See? And he's like, "I didn't see anything."
Right. Like, I don't know. I just so very feel like the way that they conducted this investigation.
Yeah.
If you're going to do things in a way that lead to more questions than answers, then
probably not doing a very good investigation.
I would say so. I would say so. I think even like anybody who listens to this podcast or anybody who watches these kind of things would be like, "Okay, but so tell me exactly what you saw."
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. I'm not saying they didn't say that, but it's just, they haven't, they're not, they're like 0 for like 11 at this point, I feel like.
Yeah, definitely. Student engineer Olivares gave his sworn statement to police on the 22nd. This is 10 days after Tiffany's death. And he said that around 11 p.m., after passing mile marker 44, he saw something off to the left side. He estimated that the figure was about a quarter to a half mile away. Olivares said that he couldn't tell what the figure was initially. He said that he had all of his lights on bright and that he blew his horn to see if it would move. As I come closer, approximately a quarter of a mile away or a little closer to that, maybe, I noticed that it was in fact a human being in a crouched position in darker clothing. So I blow my horn initially, a really long horn just to get their attention. I was traveling approximately 80 miles an hour, maximum authorized speed. As I'm getting closer, the individual in the black clothing stands up and I immediately recognize it's a female. I keep blowing my horn. As I'm approaching closer, the individual stands up, faces towards the track. And as I'm approaching closer, probably within like 5 seconds of passing her, she jumps. She dives in front of the train to the lower portion of the cab car. Olivares said that the person was about 15 to 20 feet to the left of the track wearing very light black clothing. And he also added that when the figure was crouched down initially, she was facing away from the track. According to the train's event recorder, which is also called a black box, the train was indeed traveling 80 miles per hour. The time spanning between the engineer sounding the horn, striking Tiffany, then applying the brakes was just 4.1 seconds. So was that enough time for him to have seen what he described? There was never a reconstruction done of the accident scene, despite the changing stories of the two engineers, and it seemed as though quite a bit of weight was placed on the two initial stories from the engineers, leading to the suicide ruling. The scene was never roped off to preserve evidence, and it didn't seem to have ever been investigated as an actual crime scene like we talked about earlier. The area of the hit was about 1 mile into the woods from the closest intersections. There was very little, if any, light out there, and Tiffany would not have had her cell phone at this point. Her entire family insisted that Tiffany was terrified of the dark. When Tiffany's remains were recovered, she was wearing a sports bra and black underwear. But if you recall, when she left the house initially, she was wearing shorts. She was wearing a t-shirt. And you can see it in the picture where mm-hmm. she's caught on that camera. She's wearing shoes. The shoes, I couldn't really tell, but they're apparently like a lighter canvas color. Yes. And she's wearing that headband. But none of those things were found. Her shirt had been found torn and tattered, but unfortunately, it was stored as evidence in a plastic bag that had been tied with a knot. And guess what happened to that bag? Since that's not the proper way to store evidence, the shirt was covered in mold pretty soon thereafter and was unable to be used for any testing.
Here is what I want to know.
Okay, yeah.
Say you're a doctor and you remove, like I used to work for a plastic surgeon and we often would remove like things from skin, like a mole that looks suspicious.
Skin tag maybe or something.
Stuff like that. And we would send that for testing, right? If you, and there's a specific protocol to collect this stuff, you put it in the pathology, you send it off, you have to put it in the proper kind of containers and all of those things in the proper, there's a solution in it and all the stuff. And then the pathology courier comes and picks it up. Now, say that courier was like, I'm just going to leave it open. Would they not get in trouble? Would there not be some kind of a fine imposed on that company? Or you get so many strikes and then, like, you tied it with a knot, knowing full well that's not how you do it. You didn't rope anything off. You didn't collect many of the items that were at the scene. And I do understand that they fully believed that this was a suicide and that kind of stuff wasn't necessary, but it doesn't matter what you think initially. It doesn't matter that you think, well, this is going to end up not mattering, so I'm not going to properly secure any of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not okay. That's not protocol. So why don't we just get to do that? And people are like, well, we're human. We make mistakes. Like,
because, I mean, obviously, if you've listened to anything, whether it be a podcast, a TV show, YouTube, whatever the case may be, this happens so often. Things
so
get
often.
Lost.
Mm-hmm.
Things are contaminated. Things are, they're left out. They are taken out and then put back with, I don't know. They're like, well, I put a twist tie, a bread tie on it, but it just didn't. Like,
right. Like, there's some jobs where you just cannot afford to make fucking mistakes like that. You just can't. This is not, I work at Walmart and I forgot to put the right tag on a shirt or something. Like, we're talking about dire consequences here.
Well, and where are the checks and balances? Like, it doesn't, as far as I can tell, not many are, because as much as this happens and as much as we're not ever able to report, and maybe it's because we don't know, but I don't know. We never report that it's like, and that police department was fined and there was an internal, it's always an internal investigation. Oh, I would even take an internal investigation. If there was an internal investigation, you know, like that rarely we ever talk about anything like that. So
yeah,
it's just ridiculous.
How many times have we seen prosecutorial misconduct and these people are then promoted to judge, you know, they become not, I know they're not just promoted, like you have, they have to vote and all that kind of stuff, but like they then become judges who are now ruling on cases where they have been proven to not show integrity.
Right.
What are we doing? Why do we not have any checks and balances?
Right. Absolutely. I do not understand it. And I mean, not only was the shirt contaminated, but reportedly, several other pieces of evidence collected were also contaminated. Contaminated. All of it's contaminated.
All the aminateds, yeah.
Yeah. Tiffany's cousin and uncle, like I said earlier, so they went out. They did the whole, like, nobody's investigating, so they're like, okay, we're going to go and see what we can find. They found pieces of her remains scattered around still. They found a bloody glove on the ground. And a large area of blood on one of the wooden railroad ties right by where the impact took place. They also found one of Tiffany's rubber bracelets that she had been wearing, and they collected it and gave it to Diane. They did not find her shorts, her headband, or her shoes. On August 3rd, oh, and also, very quickly, so obviously they were like, duh, suicide, hello, which is not the right way to, you can't, that's not an investigation, it's just simply not. But that's what they did. Why even collect anything if you're not gonna, why do it?
Right. Yeah. They're like, well, no need, but I'll grab this and I guess I'll grab that. Like,
why? And whatever. Okay. So On August 3rd, this is just over 2 weeks after Tiffany's death, Diane was out walking down the roads near her home and where Tiffany was struck when she saw something off to the side of the road. Just about 15 feet off of Old Tilton Road, Diane found Tiffany's shoes and her headband. Her shoes were laying flat on their bottoms about a foot apart. Her headband was on the ground about 6 feet away. Diane said that it looked like the items had either been placed there or that Tiffany had literally been pulled right out of her shoes. The spot was about 1¾ miles away from where she'd been struck by the train. And this would have meant that Tiffany, if they were placed there, that'd be one thing. But if she was taken out of her shoes or if she just left them there, she would have had to walk almost 2 more miles barefoot to get to where she was struck by the train. Photos of Tiffany's feet showed some abrasions, but did not appear to have been as torn up as one might think they would be walking that far barefoot. Also found nearby was a sweatshirt that did not belong to Tiffany and a laminated car key tag. So one that's usually connected to like a rental set of keys or like if you bring your car to get have it worked on or whatever, and they'll like put the little thing on there. Uncle Michael called the Galloway Township Police, who sent a detective to photograph the area and collect the clothing. Additionally, it was later noted that neither of the shoes nor the headband showed any evidence of blood or body matter that might indicate Tiffany had been wearing them when she was struck by the train. Detectives never sent these items out for testing. 5 years after Tiffany died, her family paid to have them sent for DNA testing. And unfortunately, like much of the other evidence related to Tiffany, the chain of custody had been broken so many times that the results wouldn't mean anything.
Mm. The Valentes seemed to discover more and more information, leading them to more and more questions each day. Why had no one seen Tiffany walking from her driveway and down the street? Why had no witnesses ever been found that had seen a 6'3" girl walking down one of the more well-traveled roads that she would have likely taken to the train tracks? And why was Tiffany's cell phone left in the Valentes' front yard? I also just want to point out that I heard 6'3" as her height. I heard 6'2". I heard 6'4". I heard 6'1". Please do not come for us in the comments if we're an inch or two off. Mm-hmm. You'll see it reported different ways. I just kind of felt like that one was coming. We get those things. And if you think about sending one message like, hey, actually, she was 6'1", I guarantee you so did 50 other people. Like, you might see it reported different ways. Retired senior medical investigator H. Louise Hausman, that is a strong name.
It really is.
H. Louise, was brought in to review and analyze the information and evidence in Tiffany's case in 2017 after the Valentes filed a civil suit to overturn the suicide ruling. Hausman, who'd been to several thousand crime scenes over her past 20 years as a medical investigator, immediately saw red flags, including some of the information that we have mentioned earlier. Crystal, Tiffany's sister, provided Hausman with some concerns.
What is his name? Sean Connery.
Sean Connery, yes. Provided Hausman with some concerns she found regarding the data on Tiffany's phone. Quote, there was a call from Jamie Hay, the girl who'd confronted Tiffany the night of her death about using her debit card, to Tiffany at 10:39 p.m. on July 12, 2015 that was answered for 24 seconds. When a call is answered, it turns the name of the caller black and states incoming or outgoing below the name. When a call is missed, it turns red, whether the caller just missed the call or if it went to voicemail. It will only say missed call. My sister's phone shows Jamie called her and the name was black with it saying incoming call for 24 seconds. Who had my sister Tiffany's phone and answered it at that time? If my sister did not have her phone with her, and was found by my father quite a few feet away from the driveway at Tiffany's home. There was also data usage in Tiffany's phone that shows someone was on her phone in an app that uses a large amount of data at 10:42 p.m. on July 12, 2015. There's another time before that at 10:23 p.m. that shows data usage as well, but not as much. How does she use an app around that time and her phone had been found so very close to home? If she, quote, walked 4 miles to the train tracks. And this was, so in 2015 were phones counting your steps yet?
I don't know about that. I don't. I
kind of feel like probably not, because I was just thinking, like, how many steps is this phone registering? Because now I can look, as long as I have my phone in my pocket. I mean, and your Apple Watch has the same thing. Like, and I mean, I guess your phone does too. But you know what I mean? Like, you know how many steps you took, right? Mm-hmm. If she'd walked 4 miles, that phone should show evidence of that. But it, I just don't know if at that time it did or not.
Could not tell you, honestly. Do not have any clue. But
even if she did, like, how would the phone get back there?
Right. I mean, it's very, very curious.
Hey, you guys, have you ever wondered about the backstory, like why we call our dad Miss KB? We have gotten this question so many times, we thought we'd release a little freebie for you.
So we recorded a Patreon exclusive Q&A last year, and be warned, we were outside and there was some wind, where we answered this question, and we want y'all to have the answer even if you're not a patron.
Yeah, so be sure to head to killerqueens.link/MissKB, M-I-S-S-K-B, and grab the audio.
And don't forget, if you want the full Q&A or access to our entire catalog of over 450 patron-only episodes with all our regular episodes ad-free, you can join the Patreon for less than 1.5 Starbucks drinks per month.
I mean, that's a good deal.
It's a steal.
It is. It's a steal. You'll get 4 episodes per week from us, all ad-free, plus anything fun we do like Q&As or literally anything else. So definitely check it out.
And not every tier includes every episode.
Yeah, we do have different tiers, so just be sure everything's listed out there when you check it out. But in the meantime, be sure to grab your free audio about Miss KB and how he came to be called that at killerqueens.link/MissKB.
So Tiffany's death had been ruled a suicide, but Minnie tried to put the pieces together that would fit to her have taken her own life, right? Stories began circulating of Tiffany being depressed and even harming herself in the past. Tiffany's family said that they knew nothing about her ever self-harming. It was reported that Jessica, Tiffany's sister, first heard this story from Jamie on the night of Tiffany's death. Jamie told her that Tiffany cut her wrist in November of the year prior. And strangely enough, Jamie apparently did not mention this when she was interviewed by detectives a month after Tiffany's death. In Hausman's report on Tiffany's death, she noted that Jamie did mention this in her interview. Quote, Jamie told Detective Acevedo that Tiffany was always sad, was stubborn, had a temper when angry, was impulsive, but never talked about suicide. Another friend told the detective that Tiffany had intentionally cut her leg in May and showed it to her. And Diane said that this had to be untrue because Tiffany had been wearing shorts during that month and somebody would have noticed this cut on her leg, right? Tiffany also had no diagnosed history of depression or suicidal ideations, according to her family and her doctor. Many people pointed to Tiffany having a strained relationship with her mother as a possible motive for her taking her own life. Diane admitted that her temper had gotten worse and that she was easily upset, but said it was due to menopausal changes that she was going through at the time. Prior to Tiffany's death in 2014, one of her teachers noticed a bruise on Tiffany's arm. Concerned, the teacher pulled Tiffany aside and asked her about it. She was concerned enough to report the situation to the Department of Youth and Family Services, so the DYFS investigated the case, visited the home several times, and spoke to Tiffany and the rest of her family members. It was suggested that Tiffany and Diane attend counseling at nearby AtlantiCare Behavioral Health. Tiffany and Diane only attended one counseling session on November 17, 2014. Notes from the session revealed that Tiffany acknowledged that she'd been making some not-so-great choices. Those choices included smoking pot with a friend, skipping class after her grandfather died, and taking money from her mom's bank account. And she reportedly had even admitted that she was, quote, just being stupid and immature. Diane admitted that she had punched Tiffany in the arm after an argument. The notes indicated that Diane and Tiffany felt as though they'd overcome their problems and were able to move forward. Diane later said that she considered the problems that they were having normal teenager stuff. Their case with DYFS was closed on December 17th, 2014, with closing notes saying that Tiffany denied suicidal or homicidal ideations, denied anxiety, and denied depression.
Question.
Uh-huh.
If you're ordered to go to therapy together like that, or just to seek counseling, do you find it odd that they went together to this session? I'm not saying that Diane was doing anything to Tiffany, but just you would think regular protocol, wouldn't you want to do sessions separately?
It could be one of those things, because I have gone to not for anything like this. So I don't know, but I'm hoping that maybe they interviewed each of them separately at first and then brought them together. I don't know.
If there is a chance that there is any abuse in a household, if you interview them together, then obviously the whoever is being abused isn't going to speak up and be like, well, actually, you know,
right.
Domestic yeah. or otherwise. Like, I don't know. I just thought that was interesting that after only one, like her teacher was concerned enough to report it. And then they do one session. They're like, case closed. Everything's fine. They've moved past it. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I'm just like, you would think protocol would say we need to do a little bit more here, but I don't know. I just don't feel like a lot of protocols are being followed.
No, I don't know. Tiffany had recently come out to her parents as gay in early 2015. Hausman's report said that he found Hausman's report said that she found both parents to seem accepting of Tiffany's sexuality, though there are unsubstantiated rumors that it wasn't an easy change for them. Tiffany had recently broken up with a girl from Philadelphia that she had been dating, and that was on the Friday before she had passed away. According to texts on her cell phone, it appeared that the breakup had been amicable. Nothing seemed to indicate that things were hostile, and she even started talking to another girl that she'd met online. The Valentes lawyer, D'Amato, said that he believes people at school may not have been as accepting, and he said that some girls in school wanted to, quote, experiment with Tiffany after she came out as gay.
Meaning like sexually? Or like, I don't know. What does that mean?
I don't know. The use of the term experiment is confusing to me.
I don't because, like that.
Yeah. If I don't know.
It's one thing if you're like, oh, okay, well, I'm kind of interested. And like, now that I know that, let's give it a go. It sounds almost very like weird science lab-y to me using the word experiment. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I don't know.
Because he said people at school were not as accepting. And then this, like, this is what he uses well, to that's describe
what I'm,
that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like, that doesn't sound like, because experimenting, by all means, two consenting people, you gotta, you know, I don't care, whatever, but to say that directly after, it's like, some people at school didn't really like it. I don't know.
Yeah.
D'Amato believes that might have upset some of her other classmates. A few various classmates of Tiffany said that she was feeling distant from her parents recently and that she was a bit sad about it, or about life. They described her as impulsive and hot-tempered, but said that they'd never heard her talk about suicide. Strangely enough, when Hausman began looking into Tiffany's death, she found that the Valente family had never been interviewed by anyone by the medical examiner's office, like we talked about earlier. Detectives did not question the family until August 6th, and this is when Diane calls and is like, hey, are y'all going to talk to us? Two of Tiffany's uncles called police on July 16th after walking around the tracks near mile marker 45 to report a suspicious-looking clearing nearby. The police contacted the New Jersey Transit investigators who sent a detective to the scene. He spoke with both of the uncles and he quote-unquote processed the scene. Hausman described the clearing after seeing photographs, quote, in the clearing, there is evidence of recent drug activity, possibly a hangout area. In addition to discarded sofas, lawn furniture, and mattresses, there were small green leafy plants suggestive of marijuana in potting containers, which showed evidence of active and recent cultivation. There was also an axe found in the clearing, and the axe reportedly had red markings, and the Valentes were hopeful that DNA evidence would show that it was blood, leading to the case being reopened. But the axe was lost. before any testing could be conducted. It was lost in storage.
What are the odds that you have for almost every single piece of evidence in this case that
the ones that you took?
Right. That it was either lost,
contaminated,
or contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
Incorrectly collected or stored. Like, I would love a statistic on that. What percentage of evidence collected by investigators becomes lost?
And the sad thing is, again, I mean, the family, they have to do what they have to, like, they couldn't call the Galloway Township police because that's not their jurisdiction. They have to call the New Jersey Transit police. They have to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if at that point they were like, it's a fucking Mickey Mouse job over here. I don't know. But they can't, and they can't be like, hey, Mr. D'Amato, can you come collect this evidence and we will store it better than these motherfuckers can't, you know, like,
yeah,
they have to do right by everything if they want anything done, and it's still not done right.
Right. As citizens, as family members, we have to follow the correct protocol. Can't help you. My hands are tied. Can't help you. My hands are tied. Now, but the investigators don't necessarily have to follow protocol. Oh, we lost it. Oh, we forgot to close that. Oh, we didn't put it in the right container. Oh, we can't test that because this. Oh, we can't test that because that.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, are we supposed to follow protocol every time? My God.
Hausman also noted that several hundred feet away from where Tiffany was struck, there was a residential drug treatment facility. Before the detective left, both uncles told him that they didn't think that their niece was niece's death was a suicide. They were never questioned further about it, and the New Jersey Transit Police didn't investigate homicides or suspicious deaths often, which is exactly what we said earlier. So maybe they were just ill-equipped, whatever. But 4 days following Tiffany's death, and here's the thing too about that. Oh, and another thing. If this is in fact what is happening, which I don't know whether or not they were ill-equipped, but what I'm hearing and seeing, especially just like, let's just talk about evidence. Let's just talk evidence. Sounds like you guys need maybe another couple training days. You know what I mean? Like something's not right here. So why is it just acceptable for no one else to be like, all right, we're taking over. This is ridiculous. Why is everybody just like, well, I mean, they didn't know what they were doing. So,
and it's theirs, you know, that they're,
like you said earlier,
right,
like,
to continue on with it, but not know what they're doing.
Yeah. Why? 4 days following Tiffany's death, the Atlantic County Sheriff's Office sent a bloodhound and its handler in hopes of tracking the path Tiffany took before her death, as well as look for any clues along the way. The handler was asked not to be told about where the train had struck her, so his bloodhound could lead the way. And the bloodhound led them to a general area of mile marker 45. And it was important to note that there had been several heavy rains between Tiffany's death and the day that the bloodhound tracked her. So it's unknown if this affected the tracking.
So a private investigator looking into the case for D'Amato and the Valente set up a hotline for people to call with information about her death. A call was received from a local convenience store worker who said he'd overheard three individuals talking about Tiffany's death in the store. On November 7, 2016, the worker was interviewed under oath. He explained that he'd overheard the three people discussing how Tiffany's death was a homicide. They said Tiffany had been picked up by three people that she knew that night, two females and one male. She was then taken near the railroad tracks, forced to strip down to her underwear, threatened, and held at gunpoint in order to humiliate her. Detectives brought in all three of the individuals who were reportedly having this conversation to question them, but they all denied knowing or even saying anything. Many people, including several of Tiffany's family members, believe that she either got into a car at the end of her driveway or was forced into a car, and they believe this explains why she seemed to disappear into thin air so quickly, as well as why no one saw her out walking down any of the roads that night. Additionally, the Valente's house was on a dead-end road. It wasn't a house that someone would just happen upon. It seemed as though somebody would have driven there with intention. Prior to Stephen finding Tiffany's phone in the yard, several of her friends had come over to help search for her. Some theorize that one of these friends could have planted the phone there after leaving Tiffany on the railroad tracks. This could also explain someone answering the mystery 24-second phone call that was answered after Tiffany disappeared, but before Stephen found it. Tiffany's case is still closed and listed as a suicide. The Valentes had a small area built near the train tracks where Tiffany was found. It has a bench set up along with a small hut that has photos of Tiffany inside. Stephen kept a promise he'd made to Tiffany and finally built a regulation-sized sand volleyball court by their home. Gosh, oh, so sad.
That has to be so hard, yeah.
Nearby, he placed a concrete plaque that reads, quote, planted in loving memory of Tiffany Valente, rooted in love forever in our hearts. The Valentes continue to fight for Tiffany's case to be reopened and fully investigated, and they filed some civil suits that so far haven't gone anywhere. It's just, I mean, they really are working very hard for this. Into Tiffany's death. There's also a discussion group on Facebook called Justice for Tiffany Valente. This group has several of Tiffany's family members in and dives further into theories and evidence. If you have any information regarding the death of Tiffany Valente, please contact local authorities. And if you know anyone who is struggling with thoughts of self-harm or suicide, please reach out to the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline by dialing 988. And that's it.
And these are super tough because, I mean, we don't know everything. The police, again, quote unquote, investigating it. Obviously, they don't know everything, but it doesn't really appear, in my opinion, that they tried to learn. I don't even know who can know everything, but they didn't try to learn much about it. No. I don't think that it is fair to, like we talked about many, many times, to just assume and then just run with that. You got to work all angles. And if you are in over your head in an investigation, then let someone know, ask for help. Come on.
But I mean, all that can do is people can look back and be like, wow, I commend them for asking for help.
I've never heard of, no matter what size the police department is, if somebody is like, we're just not used to it, or we couldn't do it, or we needed help. I was never like, big dumb idiots. I can't believe that. How stupid are they? It's like, right. Good for them.
Exactly. Like, they're doing their due diligence. Like,
and of course, we always want to know what you guys think about cases that we cover. But as always, let's keep it very amicable. Let's polite. If you disagree, whether you agree, whatever your stance is, let's just keep it as friendly and polite as possible. So,
keep it classy, San Diego.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us. We love you, and we will catch you next episode.
Bye.
Bye.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation. Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye.
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud. Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.